Okay, so today we will do Kuzari from Rehuda Levi. So Rehuda Levi, this is the first paragraph taken from Wikipedia, but straightforward enough, right? 1075 to 1141. He was a Spanish Jewish physician, poet, and philosopher. Specifically, he's from Andalusia, part of the courtier culture. Right, there's a few thinkers who are part of that culture. The Golden Age of Spain. Ibn Ezra's there, and writes a lot of very, very famous poetry about Eretz Yisrael, about wine, about a lot of things. Some of Ars Mira is written by Rehuda Levi. Well, he's most famous though for writing Kuzari. He famously tries, or actually does make it to Israel at some point, and legendarily dies there. But his most famous philosophical work, or his only really philosophical work, is the Kuzari. The Kuzari is written as a dialogue between a king, the Khazar, who is said to have had a dream where God came to him and said, your motives are pleasing to God, but your actions are not. So he sets out on a philosophical quest to figure out what is true, and he speaks to the philosopher, and to the Muslim, and to the Christian, and to eventually to the Jew, and converts along, and as the story goes, converts with all of his people to Judaism. For a long time, it was thought that the Kuzari had no historical basis. Now there's some indication that perhaps there was a historical basis to the story, that there was some sort of king who ended up converting to Judaism, probably not exactly as it comes down in the Kuzari, but there may be some historical basis to the story. That's Aregalach, that's Rehuda Levi and the Kuzari. So what we're going to do is we're going to examine probably the most famous passage in the Kuzari, the conventional understanding of it, raise some questions about the conventional understanding on it, and try to understand it a little bit sharper, a little bit clearer, what he's actually saying, which is much sharper than what people normally say. Here I'm indebted, for the most part of my analysis, to Roy Clapper, one of my friends from America. Okay. So, again, the Kuzari, like Rabbeinu Bafkia last week, like Chovas Volz, is not originally written in Hebrew, so I didn't bother giving you the Hebrew. This will probably be true for a while, because most of the central Jewish works of philosophy are not written in Hebrew or written in Arabic, or at least a lot of them in the medieval period, in which case it's worth just reading in whatever translation happens to be available. So the most famous passage in the Kuzari comes in the middle of this dialogue. All right, so like I said, the dialogue is the king is trying to figure out which religion to follow. So first he goes to the philosopher, obviously not religious at all, and then he goes to the three major religions, going to Judaism last. Most of the book is dedicated to his conversations with the Chaver, with the Jewish representative. And at some point he has what is commonly taken to be a proof of Judaism, a proof of revelation. Okay? Right? The central defining moment of Judaism, arguably, not really arguably, but for most people, is the moment of revelation. Yeah? Right? That's what makes Judaism unique. God reveals himself to Klal Yisrael, gives the law, gives everything. So this is the Kuzari's passage, and keep in mind that most people understand this as the Kuzari's proof of Judaism, okay? And then we'll see whether this actually holds up and see what he's actually doing. So the Al-Khazari, or what he calls the Khazar king. So let us now return to our subject and explain to me how your belief grew, how it spread and became general, how opinions became united after having differed, and how long it took for the faith to lay its foundations and to be built up into a strong and complete structure. So the rabbi, the Chaver, it is indeed astonishing. The Israelites lived in Egypt as slaves, 600,000 men above the age of 20, descendants of the 12 tribes. Not one of them had separated or emigrated into another country, nor was a stranger among them. They looked forward to the promise given to their ancestors, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and that the land of Palestine should be their inheritance. At that time, it was in the power of seven mighty and prosperous nations, while the Israelites sighed in the depths of misery under the bondage of of Paro, who caused their children to be put to death, lest they should increase in number. Notwithstanding their lowly position as compared to the tyrant and his might, God sent Moshe and Aaron before Paro with signs and miracles, allowing them even to change the course of nature. Paro could not get away from them nor harm them, neither could he protect himself from the 10 plagues which befell the Egyptians, affecting their streams, land, air, plants, animals, bodies, and even their souls. For in one moment at midnight died the most precious and most beloved members of their houses, every firstborn male. There was no dwelling without dead, except the houses of the Israelites. All these plagues were preceded by warnings and menaces, and their cessation was notified in the same way, so that everyone should become convinced they were ordained by God, who does what he will and when he will. Okay, I don't know what happened there. And were not ordinary natural phenomena, nor wrought by constellations or accident. The Israelites left the country of Pharaoh's bondage by the command of God the same night and the same moment, and the firstborn died and reached the shores of the Dead Sea, Red Sea, whatever. They were guided by pillars of cloud and fire and led by Moshe and Aaron, the venerated, inspired chiefs, then about 80 years of age. Up to this time, they had only a few laws, which they inherited from Adam and Noah. These laws were not abrogated by Moshe, but rather increased by him. When Paro pursued the Israelites, they did not have recourse to arms, being unskilled in their use. God, however, divided the sea, and they traversed it. Paro and his host mere drowned, and the waves washed their corpses towards the Israelites so they could see them with their own eyes. It is a long and well-known story. So we're good so far, right? Beginning of the story of the Jewish people, right? You have the after the Avos, right? Once we're starting the nation, basically, right? The starting moment of the nation is Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's pretty straightforward, yeah? Yeah, we're good. Yetzias Mitzrayim, pretty straightforward. Okay. So now he says, So now the Khazar king said, this is in truth divine power, and the commandments connected with it must be accepted. No one could imagine for a moment that this was the result of necromancy, calculation, or fantasy. For had it been possible to procure belief in any imaginary dividing of the waters and the crossing of the same, it would have been possible to gain credence for a similar imposition concerning their delivery from bondage, the death of their tormentors, and the capture of their goods and chattels. This would be even worse than denying the existence of God. So, at this point, what does the Khazar say? That, right, what does he say? If in fact Yetzias Mitzrayim happened as you say it did, then one would have to believe that this was the hand of God. That's all he's saying, right? If it happened as you said, then this would be the hand of God. So now the Chaver. And later on, when they came to the desert, he continued the story, which was not so, and he sent them food with the exception of Shabbos, was given daily for them, and they ate it for 40 years. So now the Khazar said, this also is irrefutable, a thing that occurred to 600,000 people for 40 years. 6 days in the week, the manna came down, but on the Sabbath it stopped. This makes the observance of the Sabbath obligatory, since divine ordination is invisible in it. Okay. Although the people believed in the message of Moses, they retained, even after the performance of the miracles, some doubt as to whether God really spoke to mortals, and whether the law was not of human origin, only later on supported by divine inspiration. They cannot associate speech with a divine being, since it is something tangible. God, however, decided to remove this doubt and commanded them to prepare themselves morally as well as physically, enjoining them to keep aloof from their wives and to be ready to hear the words of God. The people prepared and became fitted to receive the divine... Okay, I'm sure this was some mistake. Divine command, let's say. I don't know what it was. And even to hear publicly the words of God. This came to pass 3 days later, being introduced by overwhelming phenomena, lightning, thunder, earthquake, and fire, which surrounded Mount Sinai. The fire remained visible on the mount 40 days. They also saw Moses enter it and emerge from it. They distinctly heard the Ten Commandments, which represents the very essence of the law. One of them is the ordination of Shabbos, a law which had been previously been connected with the gift of the manna. People did not receive these Ten Commandments from single individuals, nor from a prophet, but from God. Only then did they did not possess the strength of Moses to bear the grandeur of the scene. Here. Henceforth, the people believed that Moses held direct communication with God, and his words were not creations of his own mind. Their prophecy does not, as philosophers assume, birth force in the pure soul, coming out of the act of intellect, also termed the Holy Spirit or Gabriel, and be then inspired. They did not believe Moses had seen a vision in sleep, or that someone had spoken with him between sleeping and waking. So that he'd only heard the words in fancy, but not with his ears, and he saw a phantom, and afterwards pretended that God had spoken with him. Before such an impressive scene, all ideas of jugglery vanished. The divine allocution was followed by the divine writing, for he wrote these 10 words on 2 tablets of precious stone and handed them to Moses. The people saw the divine writing. As they heard the divine words, Moses made an ark by God's command and built the tent over it. It remained among the Israelites as long as prophecy lasted, about 900 years, until the people became disobedient. Then the ark was hidden, and Nebuchadnezzar conquered and drove the Israelites into exile. So now the Kesar king says, should anyone hear you relate that God spoke with your assembled multitude and wrote tablets for you, he would be blamed for accusing you of holding the theory of personification. You, on the other hand, free from blame, because the grand and lofty spectacle seen by thousands cannot be denied. You are justified in rejecting the charge of mere reasoning and speculation. Right? So this line and this paragraph is the most famous part of the Kuzari. Right? The Kuzari tells the basic story that led up to Har Sinai. Right? There was Yetzias Mitzrayim, there's Kriyas Yamsuf, and then there were still doubts. So what did God do? He didn't reveal himself to Moshe. He revealed himself to everybody. So now what's the Kesar king's response? Right, what you said cannot be denied. Why?
Because multitudes.
Because of multitudes. Right? Because your claim is sui generis, because your claim says that revelation, the miracles happened, and the revelation happened to everyone. Right? To hundreds of thousands of people. In order to disavow the claim, you would have to undermine the testimony of many. Right? So this is the famous Kuzari argument. And then just we'll finish this paragraph. The Chaver said, I did not maintain this exactly the things occurred. Problem is no doubt too deep for me to fathom. The result was that everyone who was present at the time became convinced. The matter proceeded from God directly as compared to the first act of creation. The belief in the law connected with these scenes is firmly established in the mind. The belief in the creation of the world, and that he created in the same manner in which he, as is known, created the 2 tablets, the mind, and other things, thus disappear from the soul of the believer the doubts of philosophers and materialists. Right? So this is, as people came a little bit late, right? Basically, the Kuzari argument, as people present it or claim to present it, is that the Kuzari is proving the truth of Judaism, right? Here you have this dialogue between the Kesar, between the Kesar king, with the philosopher, with the Christian, the Muslim, and then the Jew. The philosopher, Christian, Muslim all fail to prove their point, right? And we'll get back to their arguments in a minute, right? The philosopher has no proof. The Christian has revelation to a mere 12 people, and Islam has it just to Muhammad, and it's based on, and you're supposed to believe in it based on the inherent beauty of the Quran, the original Arabic. But basically, right, Judaism has this sui generis argument, okay? Right, so this is classically how the argument is presented, right? And let's try to reconstruct what people do, and then we'll show some problems in this. So do I even want to? I wouldn't even bother with this. Here, okay. So let's try to outline what people generally think the argument is, right? Let's try to be philosophically careful about this, right? So what's the argument that goes are remixed, right? If in fact this is meant to be a proof of Judaism, right? So then, let's outline how this philosophical proof works. Right? What are the assumptions? Right, not a trick question. What are the assumptions?
God exists.
Okay, God exists. Right? So far we're not denying this, right? We're in the realm of religion. Right? Let's start with that, right? Okay. Here we're in the realm of religion. Right? He's already gone past the philosopher.
Seeing is believing.
What?
Seeing is believing.
Okay, so one thing is that you can believe what you see. Right? Yeah, okay. Forget it. I didn't remember everything, but we need to already. But, right? One, you can believe what you see, for sure, right? One is that experience is evidence, right? That's definitely one of those assumptions, okay? More importantly, right? What's sui generis here? What's unique to Judaism, right? All right, let's try formally, right? Experiencing something, does it increase belief or not?
Sure.
It should, right? Right? Experiencing something increases belief. Now, experiencing certain things, right, increases belief to absolute belief, to a conviction, right? Certain things, right, lead to full belief, right? Not just to, right, I believe it more, right? There are certain things that, like, right, if I... You know, If I look outside and it's sunny, it's more likely that it, you know, I'm more likely to believe it's, you know, if yesterday was raining and it was cold, and then today I look outside and it's sunny, right? So I'm more inclined to believe that it's a little bit warmer than it was yesterday, but that's not necessarily true, right? I could walk outside, it could not be true. It could be that, right, it's colder, just happens to be sunny, right? There are things which are increased belief, but are not absolute, and there are things which are meant to be, right, that are meant to be, right? So the first thing is that, one is, yes, experience is belief. Two is that what was experienced at the Yetzias Mitzrayim Har Sinai is more than that, right? It didn't just increase belief, like, meaning increase, but it brought us to belief, right? There's there are different ways of viewing belief, right? And evidence could be something that simply raises your belief, right? Some people think that evidence is the only thing that raises your belief amongst 50%, right? It makes you make something more likely to believe than not. Other people think no, that the right belief is higher is. Right, something to actually evidence has to raise it to the point where you have conviction. And these are all different theories of evidence, but it's clear that whatever happened at Yetzias Mitzrayim, he thinks raised it to right conviction. Right, so far are you with me? Right, these are definitely assumptions of his argument. What else are important to his assumptions of his argument? Good, right? That revelation was even greater than any other miracle, right? It's unique in its ability to prove Judaism, right? So far, what we've done is, right, we've proven what? That if someone were at Har Sinai, that what?
Then
he would believe in God. But does that help us?
It assumes that there's a Messiah between us.
Good, right? But that's not good enough, right? Because the same would be true of Jesus. Right? If God revealed himself to Jesus, so Jesus has every right to believe that he is whatever he is, right? Or if God revealed himself to Muhammad, he has every right to believe whoever he is.
And lots of people, they only have one.
Right. So now the second question is not just to establish the original belief, but it's to establish the chain. Right? So, here the argument is that, right, Christianity can't establish the chain because how many people saw the original revelation or whatever of God to Jesus? 12, probably. God and the apostles, 12. Not so many, right? Maybe the apostles. Muslim, you know, Islam, 1, something like that, right? Not so much, right? Judaism, right, what establishes the chain, right, is that it wasn't one person, it was 600,000, right? Now, there's still a problem, right? Because what's the problem that's left?
The next generation wasn't there.
Right, meaning the next generation wasn't there, right? We need to believe that this happened, right? So now his claim, the way it commonly goes, is what?
Because there were more people.
Because there's more people, it's harder to lie, right? Meaning the establishing the chain is not just that more people saw it, but right, it's harder to lie, right? Meaning I don't know by firsthand evidence that there was a Revolutionary War in America in the late 1800s, 18th century, right? Ending. Right, you know, or not ending, but whatever, with America being declared in 1776, but like, that's the history of America, right? To deny that would be very difficult, right? Denying little details is one thing. To deny that whole story, you would have had to trick the whole world, right? That's a very difficult thing, right? So even though it was several hundred years ago, it creates a story that I believe, right? So that's like, traditionally, right? I'll read you quickly, right? I wrote a paper on this at some point. So you go online, you'll find, right, people have articles on this all over, right? They call it the Khuzari principle, right? So I'll read you basically how it is, right? This is one version of Reconstruction, right? One, all events as significant as the revelation at Sinai, the miracles in Egypt, the daily heavenly descent of the manna are events that would be remembered by the people who experienced them. Two, if there is an event that is worthy of being remembered by the people who experienced it, people will not allow themselves to be fooled into believing that event unless it in fact occurred. In other words, while people may forget insignificant events, such as putting their keys on the table, they will not forget life-changing events. Therefore, while people may not remember putting their keys on the table, may believe someone else who says they did, they will not, for example, believe that they got married if they do not remember doing so. Yes? We're good? right? I will believe you. I'm happy to believe you that the heat doesn't work in the other room, right? Even though I didn't experience it, like, I don't care. It's not a big deal to me, right? If you told me that I am married to somebody that I don't think I am, I'm just not going to believe you, right? That's too big of a piece of evidence that I'm not, right? If you tell me that I left my keys in the other room, I'm willing to believe it, even though it's about my life, right? Okay, it's totally possible, right? I don't always pay attention to what I'm doing. Right? Maybe I was fiddling with it when I was giving cheer and I left it on the table, but I don't believe you about big things in my life, right? Keys Mitzrayim, Matan Torah is not one of those things, right? So assumption two is that people would not have believed it if they didn't have direct knowledge, right? Three, if it's true on an individual level, it's even truer on a public communal level and national level. This is because, well, maybe relatively easy to deceive an individual. The more people one tries to deceive, the more difficult it becomes. Yeah? Assumption four, moving from the general argument to the specific point, one should argue that all the foundational miracles of Judaism were critical events, the like of which anyone who experienced them would have committed to memory. Therefore, if someone had told the Jewish people the revelation at Sinai, the miracles in Egypt, the miracles in the desert happened and they did not, the nation would have rejected the claims. Right? Since the Jewish people did not reject those claims and instead insisted that the miracles and revelations in fact happened and even passed that information on to their children and their children's children, it must be the revelation that the miracles in fact occurred. Yeah? Sounds basically what we were reconstructing. Right? And then the second half of the argument goes like this. Right? False stories are usually modeled around some parallel story. Right? Now, so far we've established part of it. But there's more to the argument that's classically said, which is not just that this is really strong, but it's totally sui generis, right? Normally when someone lies, right, they lie in a way that is somewhat believable, right? That there's a kernel of truth. How do you find a kernel of truth so that people will believe it? You model it on things people know, right? But if something is totally unique, right, it's much harder to convince people because there's no frame of reference, right? It sounds crazy. Right? So people continue their argument. False stories are usually modeled around some parallel story. When people make up a lie, they usually do not create a lie, which is no parallel, as they would not think of it, and it would appear unlikely to be true. Therefore, if the claims of that the foundational miracles of Judaism happened in front of millions of people have been fabricated, one would expect to find stories in parallel cultures making the same claims. Because then one could argue that the claims of Judaism were in fact just reformulations of religious claims of other religions with nuances to fit the Jewish agenda. However, there are no other religions that claim to have mass revelation, one second, of the scale recorded in the Torah. Yeah?
Isn't that thing that, well, not really a thing, well, the Christians stole all the Torah, so surely they can say, wait, it's in ours, so therefore ours is right and yours is wrong.
You mean because of supersessionist theology?
No, because they went to the New Testament, which has our Old Testament.
Meaning?
Yeah, so surely they could say, look here, ours is for you.
I mean, they could, except the problem would be if Judaism, the Old Testament, was established by this unique miracle, right, and the New Testament is established by God revealing himself to Jesus and his apostles, right, it doesn't, right, yes, they co-opt the Torah through supersessionist theology, right, that the New Testament overrides the Old Testament, but it's built on the Old Testament, right, which means that if the Old Testament testified about itself that it would be forever, and then the New Testament comes and overrides it, it needs a parallel miracle of the same way if it doesn't have it.
Okay, so you say more on the basis that the Torah was made on at Har Sinai, and while there's no...
Exactly, right, I mean, supersessionist theology requires, require their argument of supersession, or supersessionism, to have as much proof as the original revelation, right, which it doesn't, right? Then the last two, so the tenets of Judaism are therefore based on the sui generis claim that is unlikely to be false, reasons 1 through 6, and unlikely to be based on other stories, reasons 6 through 9, therefore the miracles of Judaism seem to be true, and if the foundational miracles of Judaism are true, then Judaism must be the true religion, as they are supported by incontrovertible evidence, right? So basically, right, that's the classic Kuzari principle as it's presented, right? You look online, you'll see people make this argument. What the Kuzari is trying to do is prove the truth of Judaism. Compelling or not?
No.
So there is definitely something intuitive about it, right? There's something somewhat strong about it, right? It's a sui generis claim, and it requires that people, believe that they saw a mass miracle, and that they passed it on to their children, etc., etc. Now, there is something intuitive, and it's not an irrational claim, right? There is something to it. It happens to be that I don't think that this is what the Kuzari is saying, right? He's saying something close, but very, very significant, but significantly different. Okay? So let's see what he's actually doing, okay? In order to see what he's actually doing, we have to see, well, what is the context of the entire Kuzari? So now let's go back to earlier passages, okay? So, like I said, the Kuzari starts with the king of the Khazar, of the Khazars, having a dream in which God says, your intentions are beautiful to me, but your actions are not, which he takes as God saying, look, you have the right kavanos, but you're just mistaken. I'm giving you an opportunity, right, to fix. I like you, right? I want you to find the truth. This is your, right? I'm giving you a push. Go figure out the truth. Right? That's basically what he takes it. Right? So he goes to four people: the philosopher, the Muslim, the Christian, and the Jew. Okay, that's the context of the book. So let's look at the beginning. I was asked to state. So now he goes to the philosopher first, right? I was asked to say what arguments and replies I could bring to bear against the attack of philosophers and followers of other religions, and also against Jewish sectarians who attacked the rest of Israel. This reminded me of something I'd once heard concerning the arguments of a rabbi who sojourned with the king of the Khazars. The latter, as we know from historical records, became a convert to Judaism about 400 years ago. To him came a dream, and appeared as if the angel addressed him, saying, "Thy way of thinking is indeed pleasing to the Creator, but not thy way of acting." Yet he was so zealous in the performance of the Khazar religion that he devoted himself with a perfect heart to the service of the temple and sacrifice. Notwithstanding this devotion, an angel came again at night and repeated, "This way, thy way of thinking is pleasing to God, but not thy way of acting." This caused him to ponder over the different beliefs and religions and finally become a convert to Judaism together with the many Khazars. As I found among the arguments of the rabbi, which many have appealed to me, harm me by my own opinions, I resolved to write them down exactly as I've been spoken. Right? That's what I just said. Right? That's the introduction. So now he talks to the philosopher. So says him the Khazar, "Thy words are convincing." Right? So the philosopher gives him whatever argument he does for philosophy. Okay? Right? First, before he gets to religion, he says, let me go to philosophy. Right? Which is a religious, right? It's not bound to a specific tradition. So the philosopher gives him an argument why he should be a philosopher, not religious at all. And the Khazar king says to him, "Thy words are convincing, yet they do not correspond to what I wish to find. I know already that my soul is pure and my actions are calculated to gain the favor of God. To all this, I receive the answer that this way of action does not find favor, though the intention does. There must no doubt be a way of acting pleasing by its very nature, but not through the medium of intentions. If this be not so, then why then do Christian and Muslim, who divide the inhabited world between them, fight with one another?" I think. Right now, okay. I copied something twice. Basically, right, I just put something twice here. But right, so the philosopher basically said, right, he whatever arguments he gives, the king says to him, "What you're saying is convincing, but what?" Right? Right? "They do not correspond to what I wish to find. I know already my soul is pure, my actions are calculated to gain the favor of God. To all this I receive the answer that this way of action does not find favor, that the intention does." Right? What does he basically say?
Well,
more carefully, right? What does he say? He says, "What you said makes sense, but why do I know what the philosopher said is wrong?" Why? How do I know? What do I know? What did I have? How does he know that my action does not find favor even though my intention does?
A dream.
So the first passage, right? There's only a second. This is really right at the beginning of Kuzari. The first thing you find out before he talks to the Christian, before he talks to the Muslim, before he talks to the Jew, is that the Khazar king says to the philosopher, "What you said makes total sense, but I had a dream." Right? That's essentially the introduction to the Khazari. Right? But wait a second, right?
Well, if the king has a dream.
The Khazar king.
The philosopher says to him,
Tries to convince him philosophy,
okay.
And then the Khazar king responds to him, "What you said makes sense, but I know it not to be true because I have a dream."
Okay.
Right? And what's the problem? If Rabbi Yehuda Levi thinks that he's proven Judaism, right, then why does he start the book with an argument to the philosopher in which the Khazar king says,
I had a dream.
More. What you said makes sense, but I had a dream. right? And think about it, right? The introduction to the book, before we even get to this proof of Judaism, starts with him saying, look, on purely rational grounds, I could be a philosopher. Philosophy makes total sense. I don't need religion from a purely rational perspective. I just happen to have had a dream where God told me that my actions are not pleasing. But wait a second, right? If the point of the Kuzari is to prove Judaism, right? Is it rational to be a philosopher and not religious? If there is a clear-cut proof for Judaism? No, right? It's not rational, right? This is very basic logic. If I can prove X, to believe not X is irrational. And yet, the Kuzari opens by not saying that. Or the Kuzari does not open by saying philosophy is irrational. He just says it's rational, does not conform to my experience. Right? So the first thing you know about the Kuzari, the book of the Kuzari, is it's not actually trying to prove Judaism absolutely. It doesn't want to. What's it trying to prove? Right? What's the opening discussion about?
Action and intention.
No, actually. It's about the ability of experience, right? The validity of believing in experience, right? It's even if something is true rationally, right? Or even if something is not necessary rationally, experience can prove otherwise, right? Meaning it's legitimate to take as proof something which you know through empiricism, right? Through the senses, through experience, and not just through your mind. What the philosopher says makes sense rationally, but my experience is different. In other words, right, now if we jump for a moment, right, to Judaism, that means that, right, to answer the Khazar's problem, we don't actually need to prove Judaism. What we need to say, right, we don't need to say that it's the only rational thing. We have to say it's, right, it's a rational experience to believe, right? Let's try it, right? Let's try this one more time, right? Let's do another one, right? The Muslim, okay? Again, keep in mind, if you think that the Kuzari is meant to prove Judaism absolutely, then watch this very weird dialogue with the Muslim. Then say the Kuzari, I've seen a logical conclusion. Nay, logic rejects most of what thou say. Right, so first thing he says to the Muslim is what?
You're wrong.
What you said doesn't make sense. If both appearance and experience are so palpable, they call to the whole heart, compelling belief in a thing in which one is not convinced, they render the matter more feasible by a semblance of logic. This is how natural philosophers deal with strange phenomena which have come upon them unawares, and which they would not believe if they only heard of them without seeing them. When they have examined them, they discuss them and ascribe them to influence of stars or spirits without disproving ocular evidence. As for me, I cannot accept these things because they come upon me suddenly, not having grown up in them. My duty is to investigate further. Right, so I'll just give you the background. Right, one of the things that the Muslim had said to him, right, one of the arguments, if you know anything about Muslim theology, is that how do you know that that Islam is true?
How do you know that?
Yeah.
What is the question?
How do Muslims think you know that Islam is true? The beauty of the Quran read in the original is so overwhelming that one who reads it is convinced that it's true, right? That's one of the arguments, and that's what one of the arguments that the Muslim prefers to him. Okay, and what is the Khuzari's response? Right, be very careful. What's the response of the Khazar king? It doesn't make sense, but what? Right, logic rejects most of what you say. But
it's emotionally compelling.
No, it's not compelling, but it's compelling to who? To the Muslim, right? But I, right, don't know. I don't have your experience, therefore I don't believe it. So what do you learn from his discussion with the Muslim? Right? Well, that's what he said, right? Logic rejects what you say, but if both appearance and experience are so palpable that they take hold of the whole heart, compelling belief in a thing of which one is not convinced, they render the matter more feasible by a semblance of logic. So it doesn't make sense, but if you experience it, I'm totally fine with you believing something that doesn't make rational sense. Because if your experience tells you that it's true, then does it matter if it makes sense logically? No, because experience can override what I would know rationally. Right? That's how natural philosophers deal with range phenomena. Da, da, da. Second to last sentence here. As for me, I can't accept these things because they come upon me suddenly, not having grown up in them. My duty is to investigate further. Right? Said to him, the Kuzari, if anyone is to be guided in matters divine, be convinced that God speaks to man while he considers him probably, he must be convinced of a means of generally known fact, which allows no refutation, and particularly imbue them with the belief that God has spoken to man. Although your book may be a miracle, as long as it is written in Arabic, a non-Arab as I cannot perceive its miraculous character, and even if it were read to me, I could not distinguish between it or any other book written in the Arabic language. So, again, right? If the point of the Kuzari is to prove things rationally, to say that Judaism is, right, absolutely provable from pure logic, does this piece of the dialogue make any sense? No, because what's he saying to the Muslim? There are things which go against logic and I'm willing to believe them anyways. He does it to the Christian also. Right? So for the second time, both the philosopher and the Muslim, what does he say to them? Does he say he's looking for logic? No, he's willing to say that either something is logical, but I don't expect it. So even if it's illogical and I would accept it, I just can't share the experience. Right? With that in mind, right, let's just read one of the paragraphs again. He said to the Chaver, to the Jew, should anyone hear that you relate that God spoke with your assembled multiples and wrote tablets for you, he would be blamed for accusing you of holding the theory of personification. You, on the other hand, are free from blame because this grand and lofty spectacle seen by thousands cannot be denied. You are justified in rejecting the charge of mere reasoning and speculation. Again, the focus is, right, now if you come back to it, right, when he says to the Jews, right, he says, you are, right, what does he say? Does he say Judaism is obviously true? Or he says, you are entitled to believe in it because you experienced it, right? There's a certain kava mishutav, there's a certain common denominator in all the arguments that he makes, right? That it, the importance of experience, right? So let's try it again, right? Let's try to reformulate the Kuzari's argument, okay? Islam, right? Is it meant to be a universalistic religion or a particularistic religion? No, it is meant to be a universalistic religion. What do they want it to be? Muslim theology, right? Everyone has to be. If you're not, you're an infidel, right? What's the problem with it being a universalistic religion? You need experience, which is everyone privy to that experience? No, why? We don't all know Arabic, right? If the proof, right, think about the Khazar set, right? If the proof comes from reading the Quran in the Arabic and that proves the religion, that means that how many people will be obligated to believe in Islam but incapable of believing it? A lot, right? Right? Islam claims to be universalistic, goes against logic, wants experience to override logic, but not everyone's privy to the experience. That makes sense? No, right? Christianity, for the world or for individuals? Right? Particularistic or universalistic? Universalistic. How many people were privy to the experience that proves Christianity? 12. 12, right? Maybe, right? Jesus, the apostles, whatever, 13, however many people it was, right? Again, we have universalistic religion with proof that only applies to a small number of people. Is that fair? No. Judaism, universalistic or particularistic? Particularistic, right? Does Judaism believe that the whole world has to be Jewish? No. So, in order for something to be a legitimate proof of Judaism, does it need to provide experience for the whole world?
No.
No, because it's not a universalistic religion. Not a universalistic religion, it only needs to prove itself to the Jews. Okay, so fine. So for Christianity and Islam, in order for them to be coherent, they need to provide an experience that's accessible by the world. Judaism, to be coherent, right, needs to provide an experience that is accessible to Jews. Do Jews have an experience which is accessible to them? Well, yes. Matan Torah. We weren't at Matan Torah. Now we have the Kuzari argument, right? I mean, think about the argument, right? It could be taken as a rational proof of Judaism from the outside. Right, but that's not actually what the Kuzari is worried about. Right, the Kuzari actually makes a much stronger argument. Because look, can you raise kashas in the Kuzari argument? Meaning, there's some strength to the Kuzari argument. There is, right? It's a sui generis argument. 600,000 people saw it and no one denied it and blah, 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 blah. There is strength to it, right? Fine, there is some strength to it. But somebody who never heard of Judaism, right, in, you know, some country that wasn't exposed to Western culture until, you know, the 20th century, right? Can he be blamed? You know, he can't be blamed for not doing, right? He still needs experience, right? He needs to have heard of our experience, right? It's not like it's rationally accessible, right? Somebody who has no reason to believe our tradition, right? And has no reason to believe us, right? When we say that we believe that our ancestors told us the story and passed it down, is that definitionally irrational? No, not really. Meaning, okay, you can say that we have a generally strong claim, but it's not like irrational for someone to say, look, I don't need to believe your ancestors. I mean, it's very nice that you believe that, right? I have no particular reason to believe when you tell me that your parents are your parents, right? I believe my parents are my parents. I don't really, right, have any independent access to your parents being your parents, meaning it's very nice. I don't blame you for believing it, right? It totally makes sense for you to do it, but, like, I have no reason to believe it. Like, I'm not going to go through the headache of trying to... So there's a certain logic to it, for sure, on independent rational grounds, and we outlined it. But let's try for a more local argument in the context of the Kuzari. The Kuzari is not actually trying to do that. Right? The Kuzari is saying, well, wait a second. Judaism has a very strong claim. But the strong claim comes first and foremost from the fact that the claim it's trying to make is less ambitious. Right? Judaism is a particularistic religion. It only expects who to believe in Judaism?
Us.
Well, if we have to believe in it, all we need is experience. We have experience. So what's the real challenge of Judaism? To prove Judaism? To connect us to the experience. Right? Right? So that's what he does. Right? First he proves that the experience itself was incontrovertible. And the second thing he says, and there's a good reason for us to accept the experience as if we were there. Meaning our ancestors told us that they all saw it collectively. That's a good reason for us to believe it as a tradition. Yeah? Well, not really, right?
You could say they passed it on the generation as well.
Yeah, no, but they didn't have the original experience. Right? I mean, right? There's two parts of the Kuzari argument. One is that the original experience,
yeah,
right, was seen by everybody.
Okay, that's because it was such a mass scale there.
Right, I mean, the mass scale is central to the argument, but it's central to the argument of saying why internally, right, we believe it. So, right, if we want to, right, sharply understand what the Kuzari argument actually is, right, it could be that the Kuzari argument is also trying to prove the truth of Judaism, right? From an outsider's perspective, saying, look, it has a very strong claim, right? It could be, right? But it doesn't need to be that. Haraya, right? Again, how did the Kuzari start, right? What did the Kuzari say? How did he start the book? He started by saying to the philosopher, what you said makes sense, but I have an experience. Which means what? Is the book trying to disprove the possibility that no religion is true?
No.
It's just trying to say someone who already has an inclination to follow it, it's trying to justify why it's coherent for you and why your internal tradition is very, very strong. But it's not necessarily trying to disprove no religion, right? It's not even what it's interested in. It's trying to explain the internal coherence of Judaism as a religion as opposed to other religions, right? Which at some level really makes it much stronger, right? Because internally, is that a very strong argument? Right? I mean, it is, right? Internally, it's a very strong argument, which is, look, the question here isn't whether in a vacuum you would believe Judaism. The question is, given the fact that you live within the tradition of Judaism, and the story that you believe, that your forefathers told you, is that there was a sui generis experience, which is very hard to lie about, which we all saw, and we all passed down to our children... That's a very good reason to view myself as having shared that experience. Once I've shared that experience, right, for me, for those who share that experience, that should be enough to override even logical arguments. Right? Not absolute logical arguments, but even, right, logical arguments. Right? So I think that, right, there's really, right, there's two levels to the Kuzari argument, right? There's what he's actually accomplishing, right? Let me give you a mashal, right, for a second, right? Right, to give you an idea, right? This is on the flip side. You've all heard of Pascal's wager?
Yeah.
Yeah? What's Pascal's wager?
Probably
haven't. You haven't heard Pascal's wager?
Pascal's
wager, right?
Probably have, but we don't know what it's called.
Right? You might as well believe in God, because if there's no God, right, and you, right, if there's no God and you believe in God, what do you lose out? If there is a God and you don't believe in God, you're screwed, right? Right? That's Pascal's wager, right? Does Pascal's wager make any sense?
Yeah, it does.
Really?
Yeah.
Not at all, actually. It's totally incoherent if you present it that way. That's wrong. That's how you've all heard that wager, right? You've heard that argument. Right, that's Pascal's wager, right? Does it make any sense? No. Fine, I take Pascal's wager. Great, so now I want to be religious. Good, now tell me what religion I follow.
Either way, makes you
feel. What am I doing, right? Christianity thinks if you don't believe in Christianity, you believe in Islam, you won't get redeemed, right? Islam thinks if you're not a Muslim, you're a Christian, then you're an infidel. Great. So what has Pascal's wager gotten me to?
Judaism.
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Pascal's wager only makes sense because Pascal was a very devout Christian. For Pascal, there were only two options. Christianity or nothing. If you only have two choices, the wager makes sense. Right? The wager makes sense if, right, your only choices are yes or no, not, right? Right, what religion? It doesn't prove anything, right? Pascal's wager is very strong when there's only two choices. So the Kuzari, right, can, I think, be used as a rational argument for the proof of Judaism. Or that's not really what he's doing. Right? He's making an internal argument because he's saying, right, what he's really doing is saying, look, right, Christian, right, for a Jew who doesn't share the Muslim experience, is that an option? No, it doesn't make sense. It's a universalistic religion that requires experience, but you don't share that experience. That doesn't make sense. Right? Christianity, universalistic religion, requires experience. You didn't share that experience. Judaism is a particularistic religion. It requires an experience. You do have that experience. And you share it. Therefore, there's good reason for you to believe it. If someone decides to buy out of the whole system and say, look, I'm not part of this experience. I'm a philosopher, right? I don't believe the whole religion thing, right? So the Khazar is willing to say, look, if that's how you feel, fine, like whatever. Like, I don't think you're right because my experience tells me you're not right. But fine, rationally, I can't prove to you that there is a God if you're not willing to accept it. You'll just say, fine, I'm rationally convinced there is no God and there is no such thing as religion, and therefore, you know, you tell me 600,000 people say it and I'll be like, I don't care, right? Like, the whole thing doesn't make sense. It's, you know, just, right? You want to say that, fine, right? But if you're within the system and you have this experience, it's rational to follow it, right? So, in the end of the day, right, the Kuzari, yeah.
Can I just ask that, why is he presenting this to the Khazar king?
Because the Khazar king
has an experience.
Right? Remember, that's how the book starts. Is he has a dream. Right? He's looking for an experience that he can share. He can't share the two ones that require. Now, right, it's clear that the fact that Judaism makes sense because it's a particularistic religion, which is making a strong particularistic argument, means that it has more strength than other claims. Right, so if someone has an inclination to follow a religion, right, it is proving that Judaism is a good way to go. Right, that it is doing. But in the end of the day, right, so basically, right, just to summarize, right, the Kuzari argument can be taken on two levels. Right, there's the level that people usually take it on, which it may also be doing, right, which is saying, look, 600,000 people saw it; it was incontrovertible. Evidence is, you know, testimony and evidence is a good reason to believe things. This was sui generis. People don't lie about these things. You should believe in it. It could be that that's what he's doing, right? Even if you don't find that compelling, what he's really telling you is that the chiddush of Judaism is that it's a particularistic religion, and therefore, because it's only aimed at us, All it needs to do is justify our own experience to us. And even if our experience is not enough to compel others, right, it is enough to compel someone who's within the system and has reason to believe the story that passed down to him, because in the end of the day, it has a very strong internal story. Right? So, which one you think he's doing and what you think is compelling, I leave up to you. Right? But I do think it does raise some interesting points about the nature of Judaism, the type of claim for Judaism is making, the type of things. Right? Now, there are other people who don't follow this. Right? We'll see. You know, when we get to Rambam, the Rambam really thinks that, right, you need rational beliefs that you could believe in a vacuum. Right? But you have to realize that some Jewish philosophers really aren't interested in that. Right? They're not interested in proving Judaism to the outside. Right? They're much more interested in proving it to us. Right? And that's also something that's really worthwhile to do.